Going beyond the headlines to the deeper issues. 96.3 WHUR and HUR Voices, Sirius XM Channel 141. This is the Insight Segment, where your questions and comments matter at 202-319-7810. Join the conversation.
Welcome back to the Daily Drum on WHUR and Sirius XM Channel 141. This is the Insight Segment. I'm Harold Fisher. The Maryland black prison population is more than double the national average, and the ratio of African Americans in state prisons in Maryland is twice that of the state population percentage. This coming from a new report by the Justice Policy Institute. These are some eye-popping numbers. What's going on here? We're going to try to find out tonight. My guests are Dr. Bahia Muhammad, assistant professor with the Howard University Department of Sociology and Criminology, Justin Hansford, executive director of the Thurgood Marshall Civil Rights Center at Howard University School of Law, and Ryan King with the Justice Policy Institute. Lines are open. Give us a call at 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. Thank you all for joining me. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Let me start with you, Ryan. Kind of give me a brief overview of some of these findings in this report. What did you find out?
Sure. Thank you. Thank you for having me on. Yeah, sure. As you mentioned at the top, we were wanting to look particularly at the rates of incarceration for emerging adults, for sort of young adults 18 to 24, and began to dig into some of the data looking at incarceration in the state of Maryland. We're pretty shocked when we found that Maryland was actually the worst in the country. As you mentioned, more than 70% of Maryland's prison population is black, compared to about 31% of the state population. The national average is about 32%, so nationally about 32% of the prison population is black. So I personally, and I think others, and certainly the response we've gotten from other folks we're talking to, we're pretty surprised that Maryland was a state that led nationally, ahead of Mississippi, ahead of South Carolina, ahead of Georgia, which were three other states that had about between 61 and 67% of their total prison population that were black. So significant disparities between the percentage of black people in the state of Maryland and the percentage of black people locked up.
What prompted you to look into this?
Well, we at the Justice Policy Institute, we do a fair amount of state work in Maryland. And we were actually, as I mentioned, we were particularly interested in the impact of incarceration on young adults. We know that a lot of the people that are getting arrested or going to prison are young people, 18 to 24, frequently referred to as emerging adults, concentrated particularly in Baltimore and somewhat in Prince George's County. These are where we were driving the prison population in Maryland, and we were really interested in learning more about that. And so if you're not shocked enough by the numbers we started out with, diving a little more deeply into the population, nearly 8 in 10 people who were sentenced to prison as an emerging adult, so 18 to 24, and have served 10 or more years, so these are people who are serving long prison terms, nearly 8 in 10 are black. That's the highest rate of any state in the country. So Maryland's rate, or Maryland's incarceration percentage, both for everybody in prison, is the highest in the country, but also in particular when you dig a little deeper into people who are in for long prison terms, people who are in for 10 years and longer. Basically, the story is in Maryland, as the sentences grow longer, the prison population becomes even blacker. And this obviously has profound implications for both the city of Baltimore, where the population is concentrated in, as well as the statewide.
Mm. Dr. Muhammad, what goes through your mind when you're hearing some of these numbers?
It's horrible. When you think about the disparities already across the nation, looking specifically at black individuals and, you know, thinking about the attack that's on black children, reading this full report, a lot of the information you hear about, the numbers are quite striking. I do appreciate that they have dug deeply into the specifics behind why this is happening and what is occurring. And it ultimately seems specific to the report that they're highlighting that young individuals, specifically emerging adults, are being incarcerated, targeted, and sentenced as adults when, in fact, brain science has identified clearly that those individuals within that age range are typically in a modality and acting as individuals 18 years or younger. So you're being criminalized in Maryland for being a child, specifically a black child.
But, Justin, we are talking about Maryland, one of the geographically one of the smallest states in the union. And Ryan did mention Georgia, Mississippi. And just anecdotally speaking, the first thing that comes to mind is Mississippi or Georgia? Really? What comes to mind when we're talking about the comparison? Are we talking about the law enforcement techniques as it relates to African Americans, or are we talking about state size? Are there just more people in Maryland, more black people in Maryland than Mississippi, Georgia, and some of the other states?
Well, no, there are not more black people in Maryland than Mississippi or Georgia. I think you do have to look at law enforcement practices as the driver of this. We know that the federal government investigated Baltimore in 2016 in the aftermath of what happened to Freddie Gray, and they found that systematically there is a pattern and practice of Baltimore police in particular targeting African Americans disproportionately for stops, for using searches and arrests that are unconstitutional. We know that Marilyn Mosby Mosby threw out over 700 convictions recently because of police misconduct. We know that there's a history in Prince George's County where there have also been concerns about civil rights of citizens being violated by police. So, of course, you know, my background was in Ferguson, where we know that 23% of the Ferguson city budget was created by obtaining fines and fees from citizens of that city, systematically targeted on the grounds of race for exploitation. Here in Maryland, we have to start to ask ourselves some serious questions as to whether or not we are going to look into and investigate these types of practices and create some sort of mechanism to systematically reform this system.
202-319-7810. 202-319-7810. We're talking about racial disparities in Maryland's prison system. It has the highest percentage of African Americans behind bars, more than any state in the union. What do you think about that? 202-319-7810. 202-319-7810. Ryan, this report comes out at a really interesting time, and piggybacking on what Justin just shared, we have on one hand a growing chapters in this ongoing saga of police misconduct in Baltimore, and just a day ago, Baltimore's homicide rate hit 300. Okay. Your thoughts about that, as Baltimore, for example, struggles with this murder rate, as well as the issues surrounding how it treats, its African American citizenry.
Yeah, I'm glad you raised that. I was going to look for an opportunity to flag that if you didn't, because that is also one of the reasons why we did this report. We do work in Maryland. And the homicide rates there continue to climb, and to hit really historic rates. And we're looking at sort of these incredibly high rates of incarceration, incredibly high rates of arrest, and then at the same time, homicide rates continue to go up. And one of the things that I think we really wanted to flag in this report is that this process of more cops, more prosecutors, more people to prison for longer prison terms is clearly not delivering on public safety. The communities from where a lot of these kids, and they are kids, they are young adults, they're 18, 19, 20 years old, so many of these people that are both victims as well as the people committing homicides in Maryland, these are individuals that grow up in communities with no economic opportunity, no education, no early childhood development, crumbling infrastructure, and very few opportunities. When you look around Maryland, you see things like this issue, the squeegee kids, which has become a very big issue in Maryland as of late. These kids are people that don't have opportunities, and in many cases what you're seeing are the failures of the city to provide and invest in as young people are leading to these young people really having very little opportunities for other places to go. What we really need to do is stop thinking about stopping violence through solely criminal justice and instead finding ways to invest in communities and in these young people.
202-319-7810. 202-319-7810. Cheryl, calling from D.C. Quickly, Cheryl, thanks for calling. What's on your mind? Cheryl, are you there?
Thank you, I am. I was wondering if you had cross-referenced the incarceration rate with the dropout rate in high school. And while that may be the case for Baltimore, I wouldn't think that's the case for an affluent Prince George's County.
Well, that it's interesting that you mentioned that because, as Ryan said, these numbers are mostly driven by the two most populated municipalities in the state, Prince George's and Baltimore. But, Brian, if you want to touch on that briefly before I go to a break in about 30 seconds.
So, yeah, we did not do that comparison, but I think it's probably a fair guess to say that a lot of these young people who are either victims of or people who are engaged in this violence are also kids that have not been given the educational opportunities, the educational interventions at a young age, and there's no doubt there's a strong link between that lack of educational opportunity and then future criminal behavior. Mm.
I need to take a break, but when we come back in just a little bit, I want to ask Dr. Muhammad about some of these deeper issues, such as dropout rate, rates of incarceration, lack of opportunities, and some of the numbers that are coming out of this report. Cheryl, thank you so much for talking to us. 202-319-7810. 202-319-7810. Please stay with us. The Daily Drum will continue on Sirius XM Channel 141. I'm Harold Fisher. Lennox and Bowie, don't hang up. You'll hear the program. We're going to talk to you next. Lines are still open. Want to hear from you. What do you think about this? 202-319-7810. Jeff Brown is next with the original Quiet Storm on WHUR. We'll be back in just a moment.
The Howard University Radio Network is WHUR 96.3 FM, WHUR World 96.3 HD2, student-run WHBC HD3, GlassHouseRadio.com, SiriusXM Channel 142, HBCU and SiriusXM Channel 141, HUR Voices, Washington.
Welcome back to The Daily Drum on Sirius XM Channel 141. I'm Harold Fisher. Tonight, we are talking about a new report by the Justice Policy Institute that says, among other things, that Maryland's black population is more than double the national average, the black prison population more than double the national average. What's going on here? Why is this happening? My guests are Dr. Bahia Muhammad, assistant professor with the Howard University Department of Sociology and Criminology, Justin Hansford, Executive Director of the Thurgood Marshall Civil Rights Center at Howard University School of Law, and Ryan King with the Justice Policy Institute. Lines are open at 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. Lennox, calling from Bowie. Thanks for calling, Lennox. What's on your mind?
Well, I find it interesting that the two largest populations with black populations are the ones that have possessed the majority of these cases. And I also find it very interesting that the third part of this is going to be the court system. I'm wondering how many people who are getting arrested by police on serious or bogus charges are actually getting the necessary representation and justice by the court system, and how these people are going to be able to become a viable member of society after they get out of prison if they are allowed with these long sentences. Dr. Muhammad, really wanted to say.
Doctor, thank you so much, Lennox. Dr. Muhammad, your thoughts about what Lennox was asking?
It definitely makes a whole lot of sense. A lot of individuals that are going in specifically at such young ages have no recollection or idea about what 10 years means. The majority of families of individuals that you find incarcerated are not coming from two family income homes. Individuals are on the poverty line, if not far beneath it, and therefore are being provided the service of public defenders. And when you work with public defenders, what you're finding out now is that plea bargaining is a big thing. So getting younger individuals to say, hey, I'll take the 10 years, even if I'm not guilty, of the fear of not being able to even count or have an understanding of how old they will be when they get out. The fear of the incarceration itself also scares families. We've seen that in a lot of the documentaries when they see us that talks about young individuals that are swept up in ways that are unjust, but that the families are not understanding, the youth are not understanding, and therefore the system wins.
Lennox, thank you so much for your phone call. Go right ahead, Justin.
Sure. One thing that Lennox mentioned that we can't ignore is that these are not only majority African-American jurisdictions, but in both cases, we have African-Americans in positions of power, African-American mayors, county executives, prosecutors, police officers. There was a book by law professor James Foreman called Locking Up Our Own, which won many awards and was released last year. And it described how the history of Washington, D.C. in the 1980s and 90s was a history that promoted a history of a city that promoted mass incarceration under black mayors. And so one of the things that I think is so interesting about this report is that calling for different strategies, as opposed to calling for a diversification of people who are administering the criminal justice system, calling for different strategies altogether, things like investing in these alternative programs that provide job training or provide some sort of developmental training for these youth. That is the way of the future. It's not necessarily the answer to say that we have black people in power, and so this problem will stop on its own. We have to find other ways to intervene.
202-319-7810. 202-319-7810. Linda, calling from Suitland. Linda, thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Yes. These numbers and everything, data that's going on, that's been going on for year after year after year as far as locking up black people. And you're talking about the young people. And the 300, I'm from Baltimore, and from the 300 homicides that are going on, with all of these young people or whoever, whatever black people are being locked up, what are the type of crimes, that they're being locked up for, you know, other than murder? Of course, they should be arrested if they do murder somebody, but what other crimes? I mean, are there, what other, types of things that black people are doing that are being locked up for other than murder?
Ryan, do you have any information about what Linda is asking?
Sure. I mean, they run the gamut from, you know, the primary categories are drug, property, and violent crimes, and so the people get locked up and run the gamut. But there's, I think, the areas where you see significant impact of racial disparity are the ones that have the most discretion, and those are drug crimes frequently, and they're also technical violations of supervision. A technical violation of supervision is if somebody is on parole or probation and they show up late for an appointment, they miss a visit from their probation or parole officer, maybe they take a drug test and they fail, they can be revoked and sent back to prison, which means if they were working, they lose their job, they're out, and they have to go through the whole process of reentry all over again. And a lot of those types of offenses where there's a significant amount of discretion, whether incarceration is really the appropriate approach for somebody who is a technical violation or somebody who has a substance use disorder, is the prison really what they need? Those are areas where we see particularly high rates of racial disparity. We see them across the board, but those are the areas where I think the discretion of law enforcement, of prosecutors, of judges, and of corrections have historically and continue to disadvantage communities of color.
Linda, thank you so much. Dr. Muhammad, question, because as Ryan mentioned earlier, he said that the the most significant municipalities that are affected are Baltimore and Prince George's County. There's an old saying when it comes to politics in Maryland, as go Baltimore and Prince George's County, so goes. And so that means that if you're running for governor, if you don't get Baltimore, you don't get Prince George's County, you don't win. Mm. And beyond the political piece of that, when you're looking at Prince George's and Baltimore, that's the highest black population. But, you know, for example, in Prince George's County, we have a black county executive. We have a white police chief, but we have a black population that is saying, we want our communities to be safe. And you have, you know, black people who I would argue in some cases are torn. We don't want this to happen to our young black men, but we don't want our young black men to happen to us. How do you address that?
That's a difficult thing to address. You start to see around the prison populations that there is a huge divide against the young and the old. Mm. You know, kind of the old Jim Crow, the young against the old, the rich against the poor, the light against the dark, where young individuals are almost dehumanized by their own older populations that feel, on a lot of the reports, Pew recently put out a report that talks specifically about the levels of police in different areas, specifically looking at Maryland and also D.C., and highlighted that a large majority of black and brown older individuals felt that they wanted more presence of police in the communities, that they wanted to feel safe, that they don't feel safe on the metros, that they're not feeling safe around younger individuals that are not connected to schools, that are rolling in larger groups of individuals. And you find that there's a divide in those homes as well, that a lot of those youth are seen as street individuals and not recognized within their own home. And I think that results from a lack of a communication on all different levels. The families are pushing individuals out. The schools are, you know, militarized and pushing individuals out. And the police are there waiting to capture and bringing them into the criminal justice system. And so there is no kind of safe zone for them.
It's interesting that you talk about the schools. For example, one of the things that was launched by Prince George's County Executive Aisha Braveboy was this Second Chance Initiative within the school system, where she is trying to prevent young black people, more specifically boys, but this applies to girls as well, giving them a second chance after they have perhaps committed nonviolent crimes, where they are trying to keep them out of the school to prison pipeline, where, you know, or they may have a shoplifting, or they may have a wrong place, wrong time, but you know, you you shouldn't have been there, girl or boy, and you know you shouldn't have to picked up that stuff at Macy's or what have you, and giving them an opportunity to straighten themselves out before they get a record. Do you think, Justin, that is, when you're talking about criminal justice reform, yeah, one of the things that we need to start looking at more?
I think that's a great initiative. If you look at the report, for example, if you look at the question of parole violations, these are also oftentimes economic problems where people have to find a way to get transportation to see their PO. We were talking earlier about the high cost of Uber, for example. You have situations where there's money bail still in Maryland, and so people oftentimes sit in jail because they cannot afford to pay bail, or they don't have anybody to vouch for them on an economic level. So I think that when we're talking about criminal justice reform, I think the economic aspect of incarceration is often undersold. In other words, people assume that the majority or almost everybody in jail or prison is there for something that is violent or something that is, we should be afraid of them as a result of an action they did. But as we see in this report, there are many people in jail because they perhaps missed an appointment with the parole officer, or there are people who are in prison for these other economic situations, you know, talking about property and things that the prosecutor is trying to avoid putting people in the school to prison pipeline for. Those are things that we need to find other ways to solve problems that we need to find other ways to solve outside of the criminal justice tool, where we're using a hammer for to solve something that could probably just be massaged. When we're talking about our own community, I think we have to become more creative in trying to solve problems as opposed to relying on the criminal justice system for the answers.
Yeah, I like your metaphor, hammer and massage, because hammers are quick. Massaging takes time.
That's right.
Ryan, is this an issue of what is most expedient?
Yeah, I think there's no question that's part of it. This criminal justice system that we've developed is based on a very simple principle that if you maximize the punishment, if you maximize the pain on an individual, eventually you'll reach a point where they will submit and they will follow, quote unquote, the rules. And human behavior doesn't work that way. And we have a criminal justice system that, as far as I'm concerned, is built on these principles of setting of deterrence, punishment to deter, and punishment to drive people away from criminal behavior, and is completely ignorant of all of the other factors that are in society, all of the other structural barriers. And so I think particularly I have had the privilege to work with closely with a handful of now younger men who have went into prison in D.C. As juveniles and have been through a really wonderful piece of legislation. The district have been released now in their late 30s, early 40s, one of whom I've had the privilege to work with, and to see the experience of them coming back out into the community and trying to merely meet the obligations of supervision, for example, to hold down a job and still be able to have to report to your office, to the parole officer, and then you have to sit there and you have to wait 2 hours and the parole officer doesn't care. You need a very, very sympathetic boss who's willing to go along with that. Some places are like that. Unfortunately, because of the coverage of this issue, more and more are willing to do that. But it truly is. It is a difficult, difficult process. These are a lot of individuals who get wrapped up in the criminal justice system because we have neglected, as I said earlier, so many things early on in life. We have not invested in people at a young age, and now they're older and they don't have the education, they don't have the job training. And now we're asking them at the flip of a switch to suddenly turn around and go out and hold the job and do all these things that nobody's had the training to do like the rest of us who've had the good fortune, who have not been involved in the criminal justice system. And so I think you're absolutely right. This is a long-term process. It is a commitment to invest in individuals. It is not a commitment to punish individuals every time that they may stray off course. It is a commitment to understand that I like the massage metaphor as well. You know, that is going to take time, and there are going to be, you know, two steps forward, one step back. That is part of the process, and it's something that we need to commit to. It's not an overnight fix.
Let me go to Edwin. Edwin calling from Landover. Thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Yeah, I was just I can kind of piggyback off of that because I was one of those kids who was incarcerated at a young age and came home.
Why?
I was incarcerated at 19, came home at 34.
Why?
I was convicted of a manslaughter charge.
Mm-hmm.
And the way that the system works, if you're tried by your jury of peers, that once they find you guilty of a lesser charge, that the judge is supposed to stay within guidelines. But with me, I was found guilty of manslaughter, but I was sentenced to 30 years.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And with that, you know, being said, when I came home, I was 34. And, you know, I was 19 when I went in. So when I came home, I've never had a job, you know, not a serious job that I could say I had experience at doing anything. And when you come home, you know, you're trying to find a job, and it's getting kind of hard because now they're saying, oh, you need experience. But, you know, if you don't have a had experience, how can you gain the experience?
Edwin, help me with something, because I asked why, and I need Dr. Muhammad's help about this. So you were convicted of manslaughter. You killed somebody, right?
Yes.
Why?
Yes. It was a matter of self-defense.
Okay.
Maryland doesn't practice self-defense.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
They have laws that says, you know, like if someone enters your house, that, you know, you're able to protect your home.
Mm-hmm.
Or if someone is doing something to you, you have an option to protect yourself. But, you know, when I was growing up, I was a product of my environment. I was in the streets.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, there was a code where you don't go to the police if someone's doing something to you. You know, you kind of, like, deal with it.
Okay. Edwin, hang with me for a minute. So, because Dr. Muhammad,
you know, Edwin is at the opposite end now. But when in the incredible work that you've been doing in, you know, the prison system, when you talk to these young guys, and do you have conversations with them about why they are there? Is it, you know, Edwin said, product of the environment? Is it complex? Is it simple? What do they say? How do you address the why they got there in the first place? Is it our fault as bad parents? Is it our fault as fathers who are not where we're supposed to be? Is it our fault that we aren't putting money in our educational system? Are we not spanking our kids? Should we spank our kids? What do you say?
Such a loaded question. So many components of it. I'll start with, you know, within these classes and things that we are going inside of these carceral spaces, it is not about the why. Mm-hmm. It doesn't allow for a balanced dialogue and conversation to kind of start there. But I can say that a large majority of individuals who participate have reflected and share that kind of on their own. And one of the things that I find is that, you know, they are sharing a combination of nature versus nurture. Some of it is household. Some of it is upbringing. Some of it where you have individuals who have two-parent households, excellent upbringing, and made a decision to want to be in the streets. The allure of the game, keep calling your name. You find that some individuals are there because of victimization. It depends on gender. It depends on race. It depends on age. There are so many differences. Younger individuals who are convicted that I come into contact with oftentimes are acting out of anger, acting without making a decision or thinking for the long term. Sometimes it's connected to turf wars, sometimes the wrong place at the wrong time. I mean, it's very hard to encapsulate and put it under a pretty umbrella, you know, with a bow, because it's actually quite difficult. And the circumstances of those individuals who are incarcerated, we do find that the characteristics do have some similarities, where individuals are sexually victimized at early ages, that hurt people are hurting people. That's a common theme that kind of comes up within the area, as well as a lack of love. A lack of love. There was an individual specifically in one of my classes last week that talked about having an addiction to death and murder, that he grew up with this addiction to wanting to kill, wanting to, you know, hurt individuals because it was what he did well, that he was taught early on how to load the gun, how to hide the gun, where to kind of get the gun. And the hardest thing for him was to live, that choosing life was the hardest thing for him. And ultimately that he went through his entire youth without ever getting a hug. He was set on fire when he was 5 years old. And that was justified as a punishment. He was abused and molested from all of the men within his entire life and family, and was afraid to address that, to deal with it. I mean, there are just so many different stories over the years that I've done this work that I hear and think, whose fault is it? In fact, the incarcerated individual is blaming themselves. The caregivers are blaming themselves. The children of the incarcerated are blaming themselves. And so we find ourselves falling back on this concept of we all make decisions. Mm-hmm. And you make a decision in the end. And if you do the crime, you do the time. It's kind of where we rest on it. But that question is an enduring question and is a lingering question. And it is a question that we need to dig a lot deeper into and explore.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was going to mention that there's a movie coming out in December called Just Mercy, which is the story of Bryan Stevenson, who is one of our greatest African-American human rights lawyers. And his motto is that a person should not be defined by the worst thing they ever did in their life. A person has an entire lifetime of choices that they've made. And for that reason, he is completely against the death penalty because he believes that people are defined by more than just one of the choices that they've made in their life. And we know that as people who are in the United States of America, I know myself, descended from people who were enslaved, We are a nation of laws where most of the laws are unjust. I can actually say that. Think about the self-defense laws, for example. If you happen to live in Florida where the Stand Your Ground law allowed somebody like George Zimmerman to walk free, for example, same action that may have landed one person in jail for decades could be completely justified under Florida law. So oftentimes we are given the charge of coming up with our own method of understanding what's right, what's wrong, and you know, how we should think about particular actions that are taken and choices that are made. I believe that we do need to move towards a restorative justice model in our community so that, you know, we're coming out of a time period and a generation that was incarcerated in mass incarceration. We have to figure out how to think about bringing these people back into our lives, into our communities. How are we going to judge them or not judge them? How are we going to accept them or not accept them? How are we going to think about the divide between accountability, which is something that should be present, while at the same time, forgiveness, yeah, which is also something that should be present.
Edmund, thank you so much. One of the most profound things that in this last block of comments that Dr. Muhammad made, you talked about decisions. And I think that's one of the, you know, on the surface, you can say, well, you make a bad decision and you suffer the consequences. But when you're talking about young people, and like you said in the very, very beginning, when you're talking about the development of the minds of young people, all black, all young people, but particularly black people who may be living in challenged communities, disadvantaged communities, if someone does not teach you how to make right decisions, you're going to make a bad decision. You know, mm-hmm. And because if you don't, if, you know, the example that you use about someone teaching this person how to fire a gun, how to be comfortable with taking someone's life. But just imagine if someone had taken the same amount of time and vim and vigor and enthusiasm to teach that same person how to read, how to be compassionate, mm-hmm. how to educate himself. He could very well have been just as enthusiastic about being a leader in his community. Why? Because he didn't know anything else other than to be a leader and a positive influence in his community. But if you're not teaching that and exposed to that, then that goes back to the big loaded question: whose fault is it?
Mm-hmm.
And it is certainly a difficult question to answer. And it's funny, you know, Ryan. I live in Baltimore, and I see the squeegee kids all the time, and it remains a struggle with the city leadership of sitting and talking to them and talking about job opportunities, and where these squeegee kids want their independence to make $10 an hour, mm-hmm. as opposed to punching the clock where they may make $12 an hour or whatever the minimum wage happens to be doing. It is such a difficult and painful struggle. Ryan, some final thoughts from you. I got about 5 minutes. I want to make sure I get everybody in. Your final thoughts about what you believe this report portends for the future.
Well, I hope that it draws attention to the issue, first of all, in the state of Maryland. And I think in the time since the report has been released, we've seen significant coverage both in the media as well as policymakers and decision makers. Conversations we've had in the state, so that is exciting, and as the legislative session kicks into gear, we're really hopeful that this report puts this issue front and center.
Yeah.
I also hope in the conversation around Baltimore that some of the recommendations we put out there are ones that get attention from policymakers. And so, you know, the squeegee kids came up for me particularly because there was a column recently by Dan Roderick. So I'm not sure if you saw that.
Maybe I didn't, but I'm familiar with Dan. Go ahead.
And so Dan wrote a really great column about this particular a young man from the Institute College of Art who went and spoke to a couple of these kids, and they ended up, you know, fast forward a few months later, ended up developing this little business around bottled water. And the whole idea, I recognize this as sort of a small case. But what I really loved about it
was that it was an example of somebody who stopped, who talked to these kids, who developed a relationship with these kids, and then together they sort of talked about and supported these kids in developing a business model. Now, I'm not saying this is the cure to all of the ills in Baltimore, but I do think, I wonder how many people in law enforcement or people in Baltimore government or Governor Hogan who's continuing to push, you know, more prison terms, more cops, more prosecutions, have taken the time to go into some of these communities and simply ask people who live there what they're looking for. What do they want to make them safe? And I promise you the answer will not be more cops, more prosecutions, and more arrests. A lot of them want to feel safe. Now, we've put a situation in this country where for many people, they feel like safety equals prison. But what they really mean when they want to be safe is they want to feel comfortable walking down the street. They want to feel comfortable sending their kids to school. And this, the communities where there are high rates of violence, where the people who are going to prison are also the victims of violence, those are individuals who have seldom asked what they're looking for, what they need. And what it struck me about that Rogers column was it was the conversation with these kids that got them to a point where they develop this little business model, and that's what I would like to see. Opening up a conversation where the people in these communities with high rates of mass incarceration, high rates of violence, are not the subject of conversation about among everybody else about what to do with them, but to go ask people what they need and then invest and help those people in that community. That is the legacy that we need, and that's the kind of conversation that I'm hoping this report starts a little spark and can drive in Maryland.
Dr. Muhammad, I'll let you have the last word. I've got about a minute for you.
I think that we need to focus on restorative justice practices, which was ultimately discussed early on, and really rid of the super predator myth. We cannot be afraid of our young individuals. We cannot continue to utilize the prison industrial complex and make money off of them. Let's be honest, if you get a child in between the ages of 18 and 12 in these facilities that are, you know, overpopulated and have a lack of programming, specifically in this report where it talks about age-appropriate programming tailored towards the youth, it's more likely to push them into the adult system, therefore making that much more money off of them. We cannot restructure or have criminal justice reform without looking at juvenile justice reform.
I think that's a good place to stop this conversation. Dr. Bahia Muhammad, Ryan King, Justin Hansford, thank you all for coming in and chatting with us. We really appreciate it. And, of course, this information will be on our website on WHUR.com after 8:30, the podcast, as well as a link to this report. Again, thank you all so much.
Thank you.
That is the Daily Drama on Sirius XM Channel 141 for this Thursday, November 14th. I'm Harold Fisher. Now, stay tuned for The Connection. Good night.